chance to come to this lovely town and wonderful institute where a lot of great science and music happens. So yes, so I'm going to talk about a sort of interesting model of neutrino self interactions that really can only be probed in the early universe and at IceCube. I'll talk about some of the complementarity between these two probes. So the first part, I just want to sort of talk about IceCube, what the sort of status updates are, and there are a lot of unclear things, but they do have a robust source of new astrophysical neutrinos that seem to come from outside the Milky Way. So those have to be good for something. In addition to doing high energy astro, which is sort of the main selling point for IceCube, I'm going to argue that we can also use them to do some interesting new particle physics. I'll talk very briefly about other possibilities like neutrino decay, new oscillation lengths, but I'll really focus on the neutrino self-interacting case. And then part two, I'll talk about why one might be interested in this and talk about a model that we've worked on that's motivated to try and help alleviate some of the tension between some hints for EV sterile neutrinos and short baseline neutrino experiments and cosmology, the tension between these two, and then talk about the sort of signals that you can see at IceCube, which involve flavor and spectral distortions, and also some interesting implications for source correlations, which is one of the main unknowns for these neutrinos, is where are they coming from? So as you probably know, 2015 was a pretty good year for neutrinos. I don't need to remind you about the physics results of these Nobel Prizes. They were long known before 2015 even, but it's a good reminder that neutrinos are good for both doing astrophysics already, but also for particle physics, for teaching us about things like neutrino oscillations, that neutrinos have mass. So this is going to be sort of the theme of the talk, is that neutrinos are going to be very useful for exploring both of these types of physics. So we have already, a fair amount of information about how neutrinos work. We have some known unknowns. We know we don't know some of the values in the PMNS matrix, which will be probed in the near term with upcoming terrestrial experiments. Whether or not there's CP violation in the neutrino sector, what the mass hierarchy is, what quadrant theta 2-3 is in. But maybe more interestingly, there's also quite a lot of unknown unknowns, things we don't know that we don't know, perhaps, just because neutrinos are rather hard to probe. They could contain a lot of surprises. For example, are there more than three of them? Do neutrinos interact with standard model rates? And so on. Indeed, from a phenomenological perspective, they could very easily be hiding signs of new forces because they're rather hard to detect. But this is also potentially sort of an advantage if you think of it in this way. They don't carry color, electric charge, so they're not mired by these, other complicated forces that they interact with. So could show up more straightforwardly, and then also. There's some rather broad theory motivation for thinking about neutrino interactions. We don't know what the origin of neutrino masses are. Most models involve sterile neutrinos. These sterile neutrinos are really gauge singlets, and they could very well be a portal to some larger sector of particles and fields that may well self-interact. So as an example, I'll focus on a model of sterile neutrinos carrying a new U1 gauge charge, which give them interactions by the exchange of a new gauge boson. So in this sense, they're not really sterile anymore, but instead just part of some larger secluded sector. So this will be one of the ways to explore this sort of setup is to use the IceCube neutrinos, of course, people focus on their use for doing high energy astrophysics, which should be very nice because neutrinos are supposed to travel in straight lines, so reveal a lot about the distant universe without being complicated by magnetic fields or dust or anything like that. but also could be a useful tool for doing particle physics, and in particular testing testing whether or not this is even a good assumption on these sorts of length scales, whether or not neutrinos are transparent to the universe. So the reason why we can do this at all is because there's this prediction for the cosmic neutrino background that there is some leftover few hundred neutrinos per cubic centimeter that you can just think of as sort of the fixed target with whatever it is, AGNs or gamma ray bursts that are producing the ultra high energy neutrinos for Ice Cube that provides us with the beam. So this is just a totally natural neutrino collider that nature set up for us. So this is just very schematically the setup. So imagining we have a sterile neutrino that's charged under some new gauge interaction, has an unknown mass, and through some higher dimensional operator can mix with standard model neutrinos. And in so doing, this also gives the active neutrinos a little bit of the interaction. So they inherit a bit of the full sterile neutrino interaction. So this is LH, just the lepton doublet and the standard model Higgs doublet, and then H prime, a secluded sector Higgs, and nu s. So once each of the scalars get a VEV, that gives you mass mixing between the two sectors that can be probed in this way at Ice Cube. And then at low energies, you just have these unknown parameters, the mediator mass, the gauge coupling, and the mixing angle. So that's sort of the rough idea of the sorts of things we're going to do. So first, let me just talk about what's going on with Ice Cube. So you probably know that it's an enormous detector, roughly a cubic kilometer of instrumented ice in Antarctica, just naturally occurring ice. And you need it to be very big, not only because they're super rare events, so in order to have any chance of seeing anything, you need a very big net. But they're also very large events, so the highest energy events really light up almost the whole detector. So if you want to have a good idea of how much energy is contained in those events, you need to build something of order this size. So Ice Cube ran for many years without seeing anything all that interesting. And we were getting very good at just placing very strong limits. And then in 2013, I mean, they had actually talks about this before 2013, but finally in 2013 put out their PRL on the two highest energy neutrino events, which unfortunately they didn't give proper names to an enormous scientific discovery like this. They could have given them some great names like Kings or Dukes, but instead gave them, amusingly, these Muppet names, Bert and Ernie, or the first two ultra-high-energy neutrino events to be found by Ice Cube. And this was actually in an analysis not optimized for this energy range. It was optimized to search for even higher energy neutrinos. So then they went back and did a better search, essentially lowering their energy window, and found a whole host of other Muppets of rather high energy neutrinos. And in 3 years of data taking, found 37 events above the atmospheric background. So now into the discovery territory for a whole new source of astrophysical neutrinos. These events that this search their high energy starting event search, they don't have very good pointing information. I'll say a little bit more about this, but nonetheless, you can put the events on a sky map and try and correlate them with known astrophysical sources. So far, that hasn't turned up anything really super significant yet, and the distribution's consistent with isotropy, which seems to hint at a extragalactic source.
So, go back.
Yeah.
So between one below one p,
there
are two beams that are empty.
Yes.
So, what are the neighboring beams that we have? The one from the left and to the right.
So here, this just has. I forget. So this has two events. So this is Bert and Ernie, and then this is Big Bird.
Okay.
But yet higher. There's only been one more.
On the other side, that one there has two
This has a few events, yes, two, I guess, yeah, right. Right, so there's actually an update to this too. So I'm going sort of in chronological order just to, yeah. There's a small update to this, so now this bin has filled in a bit with one event, I think. But there still is a persistent, there's no one else at higher energies, and there's still a gap here, which is one of the smoking guns that I'll talk about for this model of self-interactions. So this sort of gap actually was originally why we started thinking about this model. How do you get this? Of course, it could also be that there are multiple astrophysical sources that just, you know, contribute, perhaps.
Statistics are low, right?
Yes, and statistics are low, yeah. So it's still, at this level, right, just a straight power law fit does fine. It could even be from just one source, but yeah. There's some other interesting new results that I'll talk about that complicate that story a little bit. So there are two main sort of search strategies. IceCube employs a few others, but these are the main ones. So one that has very high statistics is upgoing tracks. So a muon neutrino interacting in the detector can produce, through the charge current interaction, a muon, which travels huge distances through the detector and just leaves a track. And the main background to this is from atmospheric muons, so you can just use the Earth to block those out, and only your astrophysical source is giving you new mus, or the residual. This cuts down the background quite a lot, but you still have some new mus just from atmospheric muons. So looking for upward going tracks is one good search strategy. You also have, you benefit because you have a much bigger effective volume than the detector because you can produce a new mu, you can produce a muon, which you see in the detector, you know, far outside the detector, outside the instrumented volume. But you're only sensitive to half the sky because you're only looking down towards the Earth. And right, you're not able to go much below 100 TeV in energies. The other option is to use an active veto because IceCube has a detector at the top which can veto directly any downward going muons. So this has much smaller effective volume. It's in principle sensitive to all flavors rather than only new mu. This event selection is more skewed towards electron and tau type neutrinos, but also more sensitive to the entire sky. And also lets you go down to slightly lower energies. So these results, as far as I know, are not in any official IceCube papers yet, so they could change the Fourier and the muon analysis I'm gonna talk about. So right, with Fourier, this is the high energy starting event sample. This, one of the gaps filled in, we still have one bin has no events in it still. But the interesting thing is that we can compare the best fit spectral index, just taking the flux to be a sort of a featureless power law. The Hesse analysis prefers a much, much steeper spectrum than the muon analysis. So now also at TEVFA, they released a full 6-year data set for muon events, so very high statistics. And they're not super compatible. Which could be interesting. It could indicate that there's some somehow some difference in the spectra between flavors. But when you look at it in more detail, what's really going on is it's really driven by the lower energy sensitivity to that the Hesse search has. So this is now just looking at, sorry that the resolution is bad there. This is, the muon analysis, their flux best fit just sort of copied on top of what Hesse sees. And so the high energy portion, basically Hesse and the muon searches agree. It's only at these two lowest energy bins in the Hesse search that are a factor of 3 or so higher that's giving Hesse the favor, you know, favoring a much steeper slope. So this could be, you know, potentially from misunderstanding the background, because the background starts to be important there. IceCube, you know, thinks that they've done a good job of understanding the background, so they really don't believe it could be from this. It could be from starting to see, you know, it's maybe a two bump sort of feature from different astrophysical sources. It could also be from some BSM physics. But yeah, that's an interesting source of tension that should be clarified, especially with this better understanding of what's going on at the lowest energies with the astrophysical sample. So I should have probably talked about this right away, actually. So I said this in words already, that the ways of understanding the flavor of the astrophysical neutrinos is really coming from the event topology that IceCube can see. So charge current nu mu's will make just a straight track through the detector. These basically, since they give you an arrow, give you very good pointing information. So if you want to do source correlations, this is the sort of event to use. But they don't have very good energy resolution because muons don't deposit all of their energy as they traverse the detector. So they're bad if you want to look for things like gaps or spectral features. Charge current interactions from E's or tau's or any neutral current interaction can give you these spherical cascades or showering events. And Bert and Ernie and Big Bird are all of this type. And then also something that hasn't been seen yet that's unique to the tau neutrino is that through a charge current interaction, a tau can come in, scatter off a nucleus, which gives you one hadronic shower that you see, and then the charged tau that you've produced in the interaction travels, you know, bigger than a string spacing, an ice cube, some observable distance away, and then decays in another hadronic shower. Yeah, you need, so in order for the tau to be sufficiently boosted, you need a few PeV, something like 4 PeV or so for the tau. And we haven't seen any neutrinos, you know, at all at those energies, so it's not super surprising that this topology hasn't been seen yet.
Do they have any expectations of what the flux of these high energy neutrinos should look like, or is it just completely unobservable?
I mean, it depends on who you ask. If you ask a GRB specialist, they have expectations. Yeah, yeah. I mean,
yeah, so let's say astrophysicists, and we can ask you what is the range as always, but do they have opinions of what they should expect? Or?
Yeah, I mean, so if you look at before I think everything is changing in the view in the presence of real data.
Yeah.
So there's an amusing paper from Halson and Zaz in the late 90s, which was a model independent prediction of AGNs, which predicted, I mean, 50 to 100 more events than what IceCube sees at higher energies. And it was a model independent, very confident assessment of what AGN should produce. And it was wildly wrong. So I think, yeah, I think people are rethinking things a bit. Yeah. So, right, then the last sort of flavor probe that also hasn't been seen was predicted by Sheldon Glashow before the W was actually, the mass of the W was known. So he had some funny guesses at it at the time. But so what happens in this case, this is the only process where S-channel effects really matter in the detector. So you can physically produce a W on shell with an anti-electron neutrino coming in and hitting an electron in the detector. And this gives you a big boost in the effective area that you're sensitive to at 6 PeV. So to resonantly produce a W at those energies, you need to have 6 PeV of neutrino energy. so this, once events like that are seen, will also be a good smoking gun for what's going on with the electron neutrino flux. And maybe also some sensitivity to, you know, is the flux of neutrinos and antineutrinos the same? So, so an important point though about flavor at these energies is that the oscillation length is very small. So oscillations are happening very rapidly. So if I take just say PeV neutrino and something of order the solar mass splitting, if these neutrinos are really coming from far outside the Milky Way, then they've undergone many, many, many oscillations before reaching us. So you can really forget about the sine squared terms and just approximate this as being an incoherent sum of mass eigenstates. in the flavor evolution. So also, of course, though, you need to know what is the what is the flavor that you're starting out with at the source. And astrophysicists have different ideas of what that could be in different models. But probably by far the most studied one is what just comes from pion decay. So you have some photohadronic model where you accelerate protons up to very high energies that can scatter on the radiation field and give you a spray of pions out, which just counting the neutrinos out gives you a 2-to-1 ratio in favor of muons at the source and no taus. But then once you oscillate, this sort of drives you towards democratic flavor. And for the most part, the other scenarios people have in mind, you may have some muon damping so that you only get muons out. This gives you something pretty similar. The one sort of outlier of different astrophysical flavor models is neutron decay, where you really just get only electron neutrinos at the source. And a very small amount of taus at the detector, and quite a lot of electrons at the detector. This is one of the only ones that can be tested very robustly with IceCube. So a conventional, sorry. Oh, yeah.
I want to see the number.
Yeah. So
this is the protection. Why is it always like a third, a third, a third?
I mean, why is it driving you towards this? I mean, in part because mu tau is mixing is sort of maximal. But
I see.
Yeah, I mean,
so why is it
of course, also I should say, right, this prediction has error bars too, because the oscillation data is not, there are error bars on the mixing angles.
Yeah.
But it's not huge.
But if it has traveled an infinite distance, shouldn't it be just completely one third, one third, one third? Like equally populated, or is there a ratio that you should expect?
No, because you still.
There's still the mixing element.
Right, exactly. You still worry about precisely what the mixing angles are, right? Right. So you just. Yeah.
We don't know what they are, right? So.
Well, yeah, to some level, yeah. Yeah, so there are error bars on these predictions, yes.
So, sir, you said the two below are the only thing I've...
Well, this is really the outlier. I mean, these are the same as roughly. These are very hard to tell apart. So I'll talk about...
Okay, right. Those are the only things IceCube can see?
No, sorry. What I meant to say was that neutron decay is the only case that IceCube can really say much about right now. And even with future data, it's going to be very hard to what I mean is discriminate. Yeah, they can see any of these, of course, but to discriminate between all of these, the only one that's really going to be discriminatable is neutron decay.
Okay.
Mostly because, this also predicts the most Glashow events of any of them. And in part, that's already why IceCube has some tension with a neutron decay model. So let me talk about that. So the way that they present flavor sensitivity is in this flavor triangle plane. So the implicit assumption is right that, you have to sum up to one for your fraction of flavor. And then you can read off a given point by just following the axes, following the tilt of the tick marks, rather. So when they first started doing this with only using the starting events, so they weren't using the muon-dominated sample, their best fit contours were almost the entire triangle. They were starting to have some, so this is neutron decay. This is the pion decay, and this is the muon-damped scenario. So in the neutron decay, they're starting to have maybe one sigma tension width, but now doing this combined likelihood of combining the high energy starting event sample with the muons, now they're starting to have pretty strong tension with a neutron decay scenario. And the ellipses have shrunk a bit.
I'm a little confused about what the different scenarios mean. These are different types of sources, or can't it be superposition with the different ways to position?
Yeah. So people just take these extreme setups to illustrate. Yeah, yeah.
So
yes, indeed, it could
be.
Right, exactly, exactly. And the best fit also that Ice Cube prefers is none of these. I mean, it has very big error bars, as you can see now, but right. If this flavor ratio held up, it's very hard to see how you get there without involving some sort of BSM physics, because linear combinations of these three don't give you anything out there. So,
I'm having a bit of trouble seeing what the color scheme is. Can you...
Oh, here or here?
Well, either.
Just, so this
I can't
is
read the...
this is a bit clearer, I guess. So I mean, the color scheme for them is right. Just how good the fit is. So darker blue is better fit. And then, so the orange square is the muon damped scenario. The red circle is the pion decay. And the green triangle is what you get from neutron decay. So along this axis, if you follow any of these lines, that tells you the electron flavor content. So, right, so you could tell that the neutron decay scenario has the biggest electron flavor content, which is in part why it's disfavored by the absence of any glass shells. So an obvious question is, how could this improve? Since still, even with this combined data set, I mean, there's a lot of room for improvement. So the sort of obvious question or obvious answer is, well, just make Ice Cube even bigger and wait a little bit of time. And also really hopefully start seeing higher energy events where you have new flavor discriminants. You have double bangs, hopefully, and also glass shell events. So this is something we decided to look at because Ice Cube also has put out a proposal to be funded for an upgrade, basically a factor 10 increase. So this is looking from above Ice Cube's current configuration and where they would like to expand into. And this is called Ice Cube Gen 2. So they're stated goals are to really get very high statistics between PeV and up to 1,000 PeV range and get hundreds of neutrinos above the atmospheric background and really let them do detailed spectral studies, very good point source correlations, and hopefully flavor as well. Although,
wait, I'm affected by global warming at all.
Because their detector is melting? That's a good question.
I guess it's pretty deep, so they're pretty okay.
Right.
They're not Antarctica, right?
Yes.
It's only the edges that are falling off, the middle's pretty
okay. That's a good question. I should ask someone.
They need to hurry up.
Yeah. Because look, they have like two or three events at this level. No, we need to do it after. It's two big events per year. The energy is just painful.
Yeah. It takes forever.
Actually, how much data do they have? Time-wise?
Yeah.
So for the muon events, they've done analysis on the full 6 years of data, but that's not with all of the strings. So they sort of, as soon as they had some of the detector built, they already started taking data. And then, yeah, so they've only had a few years now with the full 86 string configuration.
So still
years,
so
yeah.
You're not gonna do much better with the statistics.
Yes, exactly. So it's good to build something even bigger.
What is the cost of the upgrade? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, I think it's around the same cost as the original. That's what I remember. And they tied this proposal to Penghu also, which is a lower energy. So the idea is to go both to lower energies with Penghu, which is a the smaller region with tighter string spacing in the center, which is also good for dark matter. But then also go to bigger energies by just making a bigger net to catch neutrinos better. I think especially with 2015 being a very good year for neutrinos, I mean, I think all signs are pointing towards it being funded, but yeah, they haven't been funded officially yet. But our idea was to look in a little bit of detail what they can do in terms of flavor improvements at Ice Cube Gen 2. So there are two approaches to doing this, which work. Some work better than others for different event strategies. But so one way to do this is just to throw your hands up and say, well, I'm just a theorist. So I know about neutrino cross-sections and the attenuation of neutrinos as they go through the Earth is actually an important effect at these energies, and make some assumptions about what the spectrum is, and then calculate events in this way. Another more conservative approach is to use the effective areas that IceCube has given to the community, which are very helpful. So they depend on the flavor. And in addition to including all of these effects, like what is the neutrino cross-section and what is the Earth attenuation effect, they also include the detailed search cuts, which are otherwise, you know, not given to you directly. So this is a more conservative route, and this is the one we followed for the main body of the paper. So the basic idea was to just take a given set of flavor ratios and let them produce some, you know, a set of event topologies, whether showers, tracks, glass shower resonances, or double bangs, and then see how well that could be faked by having the wrong set of flavor ratios, by just combining things together in a likelihood function. So with 10 years of data at IceCube Gen 2, if we only have tracks and showers, we get some improvement, but not very dramatic improvement. And we have to, of course, make some assumptions of what the best fit is for the spectrum. So here, this is just for example, taking one closer to what the muon data prefers. But assuming we start to see some Glashow resonances, you start to do a bit better. And if you have Glashows and double bangs, you start to get, you know, pretty meaningful constraints on what the flavor of the astrophysical neutrinos can be. And just for comparison, this is the current flavor sensitivity for IceCube. So we have to wait some time for the flavor to improve significantly, but.
So just ask, would that be able to distinguish between the muon and the pion scenario?
Yeah. At some significance, yes, you could start doing that too. Yeah. And strongly disfavor a neutron decay scenario, yeah. And this is also, of course, I should have said, assuming you have equal partition of flavors as the, you know, the thing you're fitting to,
yeah.
As your, the source of the events, yeah.
I should ask this earlier, but you have a best fit on the previous triangle plot.
Right, which is here-ish, yeah.
How do you discriminate between electrons and taus? Because you had zero electrons and half muon, half tau, I believe, right?
Right.
How do you discriminate between the electrons?
So here it's only from, so here you mean.
Yeah.
So right, it's really only from the non-observation of tau, of double bangs.
Right.
So that gives you some sensitivity, yeah. Because otherwise it's complete degeneracy.
Yeah.
And
some number of high energy, meaning not enough when you
expect. Right. So also when they do this combined likelihood, they're also, I believe, marginalizing over the spectral index. Yeah. So, right. So things can improve. So, and since IceCube can eventually start to be pretty useful for some flavor probes, you can also wonder how you can use it to probe some BSM scenarios for neutrino physics. So one that we looked at was sort of an obvious one, is what happens if neutrinos decay? I mean, you do have access to very long baselines in this case, so it makes sense to consider whether or not it's a good assumption that neutrinos are stable. And for one, so right, the flavor ratios are modified because some of the mass eigenstates are exponentially decaying away. And the parameter that controls this is, right, the lifetime over the mass. So it's not strictly just the lifetime, so because you have this boost. But you could see for this choice, so this is setting kappa equal to, I should have written, but it's 10 to the 2 seconds per electron volt. So in this case, you could potentially see sort of the transition between undecayed and decayed neutrinos within your event sample, which would be very nice. So this was just one example saying only nu3 is stable. And this is sort of the most extreme example you could look at, because nu3 has almost no electron content. And this was, so I assumed a pion source, which is why you get almost equal flavor ratios at high energies. And then just looking at, you know, your best fit flavor sensitivity all above 2 PeV, roughly where the transition occurs, and below 2 PeV, you start to see some tension. So you could maybe start to see some hints of you know, funny flavor physics going on, coming from neutrino decay. Another example is what happens if there are additional oscillation lengths. So these would be, have to be ultra long oscillation lengths that are otherwise impossible to probe. You know, you cannot be probed on the Earth. So as an example, so this comes from pseudo Dirac models, for example. You can have a mass splitting off of the actives of say 10 to the minus 17 electron volts. So this leads to very, very long oscillation lengths, which also perhaps not quite as dramatic as in the other case, but still can give you some idea that there's something going on in the flavor content of your signal. So I should say, right, in both of these examples too, I had to make some assumptions of the sources. So these are just assuming that the sources follow star formation, and that the star formation rate, and that at the source you have a pion decay scenario. So, but the thing I want to focus on for the remainder of the talk is the neutrino self-interaction case. So the long baselines are also very good for long mean free paths. So typically, because you're scattering, if you're scattering on a non-relativistic neutrino in the cosmic neutrino background, this distortion in the flavor is very limited in energy, where the shape is actually just coming from scattering at different redshifts. And so because of the fact that you're very limited in you know, the sort of distortion you can get, you're not going to have very high statistics to do anything very interesting at just a strictly flavor level. But you can also, you can really start to see sharp spectral distortions, like this example, which was with a 30 MeV mediator coupling to neutrinos, where you really start to deplete events very significantly when you're resonantly scattering via this mediator. So let me say more about a model of this type and why one might be interested in testing it in the first place. So half of this work is already out, and right, so it's 1511, so we're a little overdue. Hopefully it's not 1611. So this has been a very long-standing project. Right, so the basic idea, right, is to indeed use the cosmic background for scattering targets. So testing the neutrino-neutrino interaction has amusingly been around almost since the, you know, for a very long time, since very early days. Pontecorvo and collaborators were the first, as far as I could tell, to try and think about how to test this. And people have tried using astrophysical setups. So 1987A especially resulted in some meaningful limits on models of this type. And then more recently, there's been a lot of work in this direction using IceCube, now that we have a source of PeV neutrinos, using IceCube to test different models of neutrino physics. So two interesting models that can lead to a lot of interesting phenomenology are these two. So one is where the active neutrinos couple to a light scalar through this higher dimensional operator. So this is one basically where the active neutrinos couple directly to a light force carrier. But another interesting possibility is if we just couple directly to light sterile neutrinos that mass mix with actives. So this is along the lines of this secluded neutrino setup, which in addition to being motivated by sterile neutrino anomalies, has some interesting connections with dark matter structure problems that I won't have time to talk about. So right, there have been long-standing hints from LS&D and Miniboon for a roughly EV squared mass splitting. It's not one of the...
Is that model of the high dimensional operator, or does it I mean, if you do that, the naive expectation would be that that lambda is just the right-hand neutron mass scale, which is 10 to the 14 eV.
Yeah, so in this paper, you mean for this sort of model?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, because phi, I would imagine, is just mu phi mu right squared, the right down. So the naive expectation that if such an operator is there should be really ridiculously suppressed.
But it is model dependent. Yeah, so they do actually write down an explicit UV model in this paper. But
that generates detectable?
Yes, yes. I mean, that's at least their claim.
Okay.
Yeah. Also, their paper is unpublished. I don't know why, but maybe that has something to do with
it. I haven't seen that paper,
but
it's an actual book, right?
Yeah, right, right. And Koda Marase, who's at Penn State now. But anyway, yeah, so I'll focus on the latter case of models and what follows. So, and part of the motivation is this sort of persistent hint in short baseline neutrino oscillation experiments. So it's still, of course, very actively debated, and there are a lot of null results as well as positive hints. But Fermilab has a short baseline program that aims to definitively test this in the next few years, and then also Texas A&M has a way of doing this with ultra-low threshold dark matter sort of like detectors using just a germanium detector, a lot like super CDMS with a very, very low threshold. They may be able to test this before Fermilab does. So there's going to be, one way or another, it will be settled in the near term. But at some level, some people have in mind that this is already ruled out anyway by cosmology, because N effective is not 4. But if Planck's recent measurement stands, is very far away from 4. So how do you get around this?
Wait, could you
explain
the lobster?
Yeah. Right. So sorry, these are sort of a best fit to, I think, a combined data analysis of LS&D and Miniboon. So sort of the target that you'd like to search for. And then these exclusion contours are what they would see. I mean, their sensitivity for this experiment from Texas A&M.
And the solar in Kamland, it's an exclusion there?
Right.
That line? So that line is excluded?
To the right is excluded, right?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Right.
Okay. So and for also to the right is what is excluded.
To the right is what would be excluded with this projection. This projected experiment. So this is the mixing angle between mass eigenstate 1 and 4 and the delta m squared. Right. Yeah. Sorry, I should have explained more about the. So let me say a little bit more about this delta n effective of 4 and ways of getting around that. So sterile neutrinos in the early universe, are this interesting interplay of oscillations and collisions. And sort of an important reference temperature is that the active neutrinos decouple at around 2 MeV from the rest of the plasma. So if sterile neutrinos are in equilibrium with the bath before then, and they fully equilibrate, that's bad. You have an effective of 4. But again, at these temperatures, oscillations are rapid. So the active to sterile transition, you can really just approximate as a half sine squared 2 theta. And the interesting thing is that collisions actually care about flavor. So every time you collide, which is frequent at these temperatures, you're projecting onto the flavor basis, and you allow oscillations to restart. So the total rate of flavor change is a cross-section from standard model scattering, a number density, and the rate of oscillating from active to sterile. So you can just set this equal to the Hubble rate to solve for the temperature at which this process equilibrates, and you get that it's around 10 MeV, which is indeed above 2 MeV, so that's a problem. You have sterile neutrinos with mixing angles of order 0.1, like the short baseline experiments prefer, really do lead to an effective of around 4. But maybe this story doesn't hold for self-interacting sterols. So models along these lines have been studied in recent years. And one sort of basic idea is if you allow the sterile neutrinos to interact with a new gauge force, then their in-medium mixing is different. So now they have an effective potential generated by this bubble diagram, which if it's big, can make this sine squared 2 theta in medium, in matter, be very small. Roughly speaking, you just need the effective matter potential to be bigger than the vacuum part of the Hamiltonian, the delta m squared over 2e. So this is just a plot sort of showing roughly what you expect. So this is the effective potential as a function of temperature. And so anytime you're in this regime where the black curve, so the dashed blue and red are just analytic approximations to what's happening in the high temperature or low temperature regimes, but the black's sort of the exact matter potential. Anytime the black is much, much bigger than the green, you're going to have very, very small mixing angles. And you can see that for this case, where this is like, say, just for an example, a 10 MeV mediator with a 0.1 gauge coupling, at the relevant temperatures around the MeV scale, you're in this regime where you're, you know, very strongly suppressed. And the basic estimates were also done many, many years ago. These analytic expressions were from Mjotsud, Rufelt, and Weldon. But these pair of PRLs, which were like the same day, basically stopped at the discussion at this level and just said, okay, we can arrange for it. But it's interesting to go further and see what happens actually once you eventually, right, you're going to lose. Eventually, the interaction turns off and vacuum oscillations start. And this will lead to a certain amount of recoupling between the actives and sterile neutrinos. So it's worthwhile going a bit further in this. Right, the process to worry about is active sterile scattering into two sterols. And this sort of scattering process can lead to exactly the same problem of producing delta ineffective of 1. You don't want this to be happening above a few MeV either. So roughly for a lot of the parameter space, this basic approximation works, the same sort of estimate I was doing before. You just take now a temperature-dependent mixing angle times a scattering rate, now determined by this new gauge interaction, and the number density of the sterols. So now, if I'm in this regime where I have strong mixing angle suppression, I can make the approximation that the effective potential is really dominating. I have really small mixing. And again, let me just now re-estimate when does this recoupling now between the sterols and actives happen? So just to do this very schematically so that I could do it, you know, in 2 seconds, let's assume that we're in the what's called the Weldon regime, where the effective potential is of order just the temperature. So now I take the in-medium mixing angle times a cross-section appropriate for a light mediator and a relativistic number density and set it equal to the Hubble rate. I get something that's better than before, but not wildly better. I get recoupling happens just a bit below 2 MeV, so this is OK. Not going to have thermalization and recoupling between the actives and sterols, but it's not very close, so it's certainly, but it is close, rather. So it's worth going into some more detail. The other important thing about this is that if I'm in the regime where scattering is, the scattering rate is the fastest timescale, then decoherence effects start to be important, and this naive expression breaks down. And you can sort of tell schematically. So let me take the regime where, so this is the scattering rate among sterols, is the fastest thing in the problem. It's much bigger than the oscillation rate. So flavor evolves, right, just going as sine squared times the oscillation length. or oscillation time times t, and is interrupted by a flavor measure. So you're scattering now very, very, very rapidly. So essentially, this is sort of like the quantum Zeno effect. I mean, you're forcing it to stay in a flavor, I can say, so it never is allowed to evolve away from that. So it's not super surprising that this rate of flavor change is different in this case. And right, the rate at which you're interrupting it is determined by the collision time, this TD. So you can roughly estimate that in the limit where scattering is very fast, the rate of flavor conversion goes to zero, actually, as I make this faster and faster and faster. So this is really only important when I have very, very light mediators, but it's a qualitatively important effect that was overlooked in the earlier papers. So I'll show, actually, in just one more slide. So right. So also just to show in a little more detail what's happening, roughly speaking, the only things you need to worry about are the mixing angle and the scattering rate and how they evolve in temperature. And they basically go together in telling you what the recoupling rate is. So you have quite a lot of sharp features because you have these MSW resonances, which happen from switching when you go from the effective matter potential being of order the vacuum energy. And because of these sharp features, right, it's going to be very, very sensitive to the mass and the precise coupling that you choose. And you can sort of see these features showing up as you transition into different regimes. So to answer your question, so now what I'm showing here is the temperature of recoupling, so when this process does recouple the two populations as a function of the mediator mass, and here I fix the gauge coupling to be 10 to the minus 2, just as an example. And what I want is for the red line to always be below a few MeV, say 2 MeV. So actually, the damped case, which has very light mediators, does very good, actually, at giving you sufficiently late recoupling.
Is there an effective mixing to the bottle in that case? In
case so,
because you couple to the active neutrino, so is there any effective
mixing
to the
bottle? I mean, at mini loop level, I guess, right? But
yeah, but the bounds from on massive things if this is a vector mediator here,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So if it's a vector, massive vector that mixes with a photon, there the mixing is constrained to be 10 minus 14 or something.
No, that's only it's measuring standard model stuff.
Right. So if you have
this is going to depend on the insects to be stereo.
Right. Right.
No, there is bounds from stellar cooling, right? Those don't care where you mix all
carbon. Oh, that's not 14 stuff.
How much is
I mean,
at 1 MeV,
also
at 1 MeV is there, right?
It's there, but it's not that. I think
no,
it
decouples, right?
I can't know exactly where it is.
And the cooling limits, I thought, also only work for sort of a range of couplings anyway, right? Because if you...
The cooling limits, the super
right.
low, and also the, yes, but if you have a mix into the photon, this is just from the mix into the photon. Please continue, we can check this
later. So right, this is just to show, well, two things. One, that you can have sufficiently late recoupling, and things can be okay with cosmology, but also, I didn't have time to talk about these different analytic estimates, but they're basically as simple as the ones I was showing very schematically earlier, that you can see the full numerical result really following in the different regimes very well. So this is Weldon, just meaning where scattering and matter potential are appropriate for a light mediator, so basically that the temperature is large compared to the mediator mass, and damping is important. Eventually you increase the mediator mass and the damping term drops out, but you're still in a regime where scattering and the matter potential really don't depend on the mediator mass very much. Eventually, you start to enter a regime where S-channel scattering really dominates, and then eventually only contact interactions are what's relevant. And contact almost doesn't work for getting.
So just come back to that point, the claim bound to supernova 10 to minus 10 on the coupling, but that's wrong.
So the other thing, too, is that whatever is going on inside supernova with a model like this, I don't think has been really well studied. I mean, it's rather. Yeah.
No, not for the exam happening, I agree, but we should have a kinetic mixing with the photon, just from that.
No, I'm saying the bounces in the supernova from the mixing with the photon around, that are usually from dots.
Oh, this is from the.
No, aren't there the stellar and stuff?
No, yeah. not past NV. This thing is, I mean, this thing has got, this media
no,
has got
this
mass
is,
over
no,
NV.
This is, there's EV. If there's
so,
EV.
Oh,
and this goes down to the sun scale.
I thought
so. I'll also talk
sorry.
About.
I thought it was in the case there.
No.
I only remember that region.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Then it's the.
So I'll talk about some other constraints that actually eliminate this window. But
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go.
From
We can discuss this.
But this is an interesting point. But I don't. My guess, my feeling is because I've looked at this a bit too that it's not going to be a very strong constraint. But it's worth going back to. So now, right. Let's go back to Antarctica. I mean, the early universe is also. Well, no, it's a little warmer. so back to the on. So let's also just let me show roughly why meteor masses of order the scale are interesting. Okay, so you want significant scattering to happen between you and the source. So let's imagine a gigaparsec scale source. So the neutrino relic density is very big, actually, compared to, say, like 100 GeV WIMP. You really win by having much bigger number densities. So you need a cross-section bigger than, say, 10 to the minus 31 centimeters squared, which is, at these energies, much bigger than the standard model cross-section, as you would guess, since neutrinos are supposed to be transparent to the universe at these energies. But it's important to point out, right, that the standard model also predicts that neutrinos are not transparent at ultra high energies, because eventually you can start to resonantly produce the Z. So you need to go out to really, really high energies to see this. But the same sort of phenomenology occurs in our model.
This is
with,
from the scattering of the cosmic neutrino.
Yeah. So this, they assumed, I think, like a 0.1 EV relic neutrino that it's scattering on. I mean, yeah, the other interesting thing is what happens if the relic neutrino is very small. If its mass is very small compared to the temperature, then you have thermal broadening, and then you can affect a much bigger range of energies with the S-channel resonance. But our setup does basically the same thing, just moves this feature down in energy. So the center mass energy available, right, is just 2 mu e nu, assuming it's non-relativistic. We want to see, you know, what mass mediators we have access to. And right, another important unknown in neutrino physics is what's the absolute scale of neutrino masses. We just know mass squared differences right now. But let's say it's square root of the solar splitting. This tells you that you have access to making resonantly mediators of order 10 MeV, which is in the right ballpark for what we need for the early universe to reconcile EV sterile neutrinos with cosmology. So there are a few processes the model can lead to, right? So we have active neutrinos from the high energy source, from GRBs or AGNs or whatever it is. So those can scatter on steriles in the CNUB, but also actives. The actives are more suppressed because you have, you know, double mixing angle insertion. But also, you know, it's also important because it leads to a resonant absorption feature at different energies. So since, you know, this is an EV relic particle you're scattering on, and this is something presumably less than an EV, where you have a lower resonant energy for the scattering on the sterile state. And oscillations, right, I already said, are very fast. So we can just take whatever our source model is and project it onto the mass eigenstate basis right away. And then consider scattering in at the level of mass eigenstates. And we have to make some assumptions about how the sources are distributed in redshift. So again, we just take the star formation rate, and then at the end of the day, just project back onto flavor basis when we get to the detector. So this is one example. So here we took a GRB model and a cosmogenic. So this is like a GZK source of neutrinos at very high energies. So GRBs are dominating over the energies tested by IceCube so far. So the dashed black, this is now E squared times the flux as a function of energy. GRBs give you something flat in E squared times the flux. And the dashed black is just the unabsorbed flux, the original one, if neutrinos were not self-interacting. And just for reference, this is the atmospheric background. So, and the interesting thing is you see four big absorption features coming from the three actives and the one sterile, which is the heaviest one, so that's why it's at the lowest energies. So unfortunately, the one on the sterile is hidden below the background in this case. This is taking a 10 MeV mediator. And right, the lightest active neutrino, as I was saying before, has sort of this broadened absorption feature that affects a wide range of energies rather than just sort of this narrow band that you have for non-relativistic scattering. And so we just show a few examples. As you go up in gauge coupling, the T-channel contribution from the scattering really starts to dominate. And this is also taking a very small mixing angle. So the orange is really something closer to what you would get expect in a model, reconciling the short baseline physics and cosmology. So you can have a lot of different phenomenology. So, and also in this Bloom, Hook, and Marasse paper, which involves coupling directly to the actives, the other interesting thing that you get is that in addition to digging troughs in the flux, because you only couple directly to the actives, you have to do something with that flux. So you basically remove flux at some energies, and then it piles up at lower energies. So they see, some bumps. So they have, this very funny sort of wiggle feature. So this is just one example of one, each curve is one set of couplings and mixing angles. You can imagine exploring all of the phenomenology by changing the mediator mass, but also allowing for our uncertainty on what the absolute scale of neutrino masses is. But these are the sorts of things to look for in IceCube data, which may already be somewhat present. The other interesting thing that the model has implications for are source correlations. So this is really, I think scientifically the most important thing that IceCube will do next is figure out what are these neutrinos coming from by looking at catalogs of objects to see if they correlate with anything that we can see. And the implication from this model is that, since the sources at the largest distances have had the greatest chance of scattering, it's going to screen out those distances. So sort of induce a neutrino redshift horizon, which gives rise to a bigger local to diffuse flux. You should see more events from the local universe than what you would predict naively, because you're getting all the stuff from far away is being screened out. And this is actually exactly what's seen in this recent paper. I don't know why this is really weird. It looks okay on my screen and then not here. But so sorry about the resolution. This is comparing some star-forming regions, which are the colored squares and circles, and overlaying them with the IceCube uncertainty regions. So the IceCube uncertainty regions are pretty big because this data sample is non-muon events. So it'd be interesting to go back and do this with the recently released muon data sample. But they find a fairly significant p-value, less than 0.001. So pretty interesting correlation. And they point out in the paper that from their estimates, assuming these should track star formation rate, they estimate that only 2% of the total flux should come from within 15 megaparsecs, but they see a much bigger percentage, something more like 20%, which could be saying maybe the Milky Way is kind of funny, but the local universe is an outlier, or could be some evidence that their neutrinos have undergone some scattering. And now, so sort of to put these things together, so I talked about the what goes on in the early universe and also what could be seen at Ice Cube. So here I fixed the neutrino oscillation parameters to be sort of best fit from short baseline physics and then vary the mediator mass and the coupling. So in black is where, shaded black, is where you have recoupling above 3 MeV. So this would lead to an effective of 4. So this is for sure not allowed. So we shade that out. We can also, though, have, depending on the precise temperature which recoupling occurs, you could have some partial population of the sterile state at, you know, a value less than a fully thermalized neutrino. So this is going down to recoupling as low as 1 MeV for this partial repopulation in gray, which could be tested with better CMB data, for example. The resonant spectral features, which I talked a lot about, could be seen in the red regions. So the reason for the funny shape is the slant is really just coming from mean free path. So it's really just as simple as that, mean free path for S-channel scattering. And you can't go lower than a certain energy. In this case, this is scattering on the active neutrinos. You can't go lower than a certain energy because it's below the atmospheric background, which is around 100 TeV. So if you had some good way of getting rid of that background, maybe you could fill in this region there. But barring that, IceCube can't probe that region from spectral features. The sterile state lets you go down to smaller coupling because it's less suppressed through mixing angle suppression, and lets you go down to slightly lower mediator masses as well, down to 10 to the 5 EV. But again, you have that cutoff because everything else below that's buried below background. And then we showed just two different examples of the sort of neutrino horizon that you could produce. Something smaller than 50 megaparsecs is probably not okay from the point of view of having an isotropic signal, because we know that the universe, you know, within 50 megaparsecs is not super isotropic. So that's probably ruled out. The other important thing is the purple region, which rules out a lot of the otherwise okay sort of ultra low mediator mass regime, because of the fact that now in this chunk of space, the parameter space, the interaction is so strong that even the actives inherit enough to mess up their free streaming properties, so they're not free streaming in that window. So that's probably also not a good thing. But sort of, I think an important take-home message from it is that there's not a lot of white in the plot, which is, you know, otherwise, you know, impossible to reach parameter space or hard to reach parameter space. And it's nice that there is sort of this complementarity between early universe and Ice Cube sensitivity.
So the red, the orange, and the blue is what the Ice Cube can see.
From just absorption features, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And this is not current. This is maybe the future Ice Cube we upgrade.
So this is the best that Ice Cube could possibly do, that any neutrino telescope could possibly do. Yeah, yeah. Right. So potentially, though, if you're in this region of parameter space, say the orange, you'll also have spectral features, but also have potentially some neat implications for the source correlations. So, right, when you're, you know, in the bigger coupling regime, lots of things can happen. So I think, yeah, whether or not this model is realized in nature, I think really source correlations are the thing to look at in the future with Ice Cube, which is only going to improve with better analysis, especially in the muon channel, which have really good pointing. And so that's it. I think, yeah, I'll end here. Thanks. Sorry, I'm a bit over time.
Yeah, lots of questions.
Yeah.
Any last questions?
Yeah, yeah.
Can make the last comment?
Yeah.
So the same thing can from like a plant, they are assuming any actual radiation in pre-screening. So if it's actually interacting, like in some of your cases, then the same thing can, the constraint is actually much looser. You can actually allow the effect up to one.
Right, right, yes. So yeah, it's an interesting thing to explore in detail what this model, how to constrain this model from the CMB. Yeah. Because it's very, it's rather different from the standard case.
Some of the models that came out
of, and what?
Some of the models that we think is rolled out from the FMFV is okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's something I would like to do actually. But right, we haven't gotten there yet. Yeah.
So you discussed avoiding the bounds on an effective by a repopulation mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
How are you preventing a population in the first place, let's say,
of the steriles, for example? Right. So there can be, so this is sort of model dependent, right? I mean, so it depends on what's going on at higher temperatures.
Okay.
Yeah.
Operator that you wrote down being a higher dimensional operator wouldn't have produced a population of them?
So it also depends on what scale the scalars get of VEV. So right, for now we're sort of trying to, I mean, we're mostly actually following the earlier papers in terms of making minimal, a minimal number of assumptions different from them. So I agreed that the full parameter space should be better explored and things like this. Yeah, can for sure change everything.
We are assuming a negligible population around, I'd say, 100.
That's not totally negligible. I mean, the fiducial, in the model setup we have now, the fiducial prediction is something like delta n effective of 0.2 from without any recoupling. Yeah, yeah. But that's a good point. Any other questions?
Let's stay here.
Thanks.